Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
I know the State Department that I'm walking into today is not the same one that I left 4 years ago. A lot has changed. The world has changed. The department has changed. And we need only look around to see that. We at State have a role to play in all of this. And I believe it starts with rebuilding morale and trust. This is a priority for me because we need a strong department for the United States to be strong in the world. So we've got our work cut out for us. But I am confident we will succeed.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking at the State Department yesterday, his first full day on the job. He last worked in that building during the Obama administration, and he returns to find 1,000 fewer employees. Many of them had deep expertise. So Blinken will have to restaff the department as he confronts serious problems. Iran, untethered from the nuclear agreement, an emboldened Russia, a strengthened China, a pandemic and climate change creating instability everywhere, ongoing wars in Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and restoring trust with America's allies. Here to talk about the state of the State Department and Biden's foreign policy agenda is Laura Jakes, diplomatic correspondent for The New York Times. Hi, Laura.
Hey, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Let's begin with the inside job, the task of restaffing the State Department. How is Blinken going to do that?
Well, I think he will look first at recruiting some of the very seasoned experts who left the State Department during the Trump administration. We have already seen that happen in several cases. I know in the European Bureau, he brought in some former diplomats who had gone to think tanks. I think that's also the case up at the U.S. mission at the United Nations. So he is going to be looking for those seasoned people, but it's also expected that he will be looking to recruit more people, especially more people of color, more people, more women, more people who can represent different parts of America, so that the State Department does not kind of revert to the pale male and Yale organization it has been of years past.
Right. And a sharp contrast to what his predecessor, Mike Pompeo, said on his last day, that, quote, multiculturalism is not who America is. So obviously,
that's right.
He is that's a sharp contrast to what Mike Pompeo was saying there. What about in terms of how Mike Pompeo represented America in the world, kind of an America first agenda? How will Blinken depart from that?
Well, the first thing on his mind is rebuilding alliances. He has said that in order for the United States to lead in the world, it must be part of alliances, that only together can the world really enact major changes. The Pompeo and the Trump administration's America First had a diplomatic style of kind of my way or the highway. You'll see Mr. Blinken do a lot more of diplomacy by convincing instead of coercion.
And who does he need to talk to in terms of our allies to reassure them? Who's at the top of his agenda?
I think he would say that Europe is, that so many of the traditional alliances between the United States and Europe had really kind of shattered or fragmented during the Trump administration. And that left a pathway for adversaries to come in. For example, in Eastern Europe, we saw China build bridges. We've seen China work with some of the European partners on 5G technology, Germany, for example. We've also seen Germany partner with Russia on a gas pipeline, Nord Stream 2. And these are all sort of interests that the United States, if it didn't object to some of these projects, that at least wanted to be there first, or be kind of have the right of first refusal for some of these alliances. And so I think you'll see Mr. Blinken first look towards Europe and solidifying some of these alliances and mending some of these cracks. And that will also be important when the, Trump administration, when the Biden administration wants to re-enter some of these multilateral organizations, like the World Health Organization, like the nuclear program, the plans to try to limit Iran's nuclear program that the Trump administration withdrew from in 2015. You almost have to have Europe on your side in order to tackle these things.
Right. Well, let's talk about Iran. I think Iran is itchy to get Joe Biden's attention when it comes to the nuclear deal. Iran wants to get back into it, right? So is that at the top of Biden's foreign policy agenda to re-enter the nuclear agreement with Iran?
It's certainly one of them, but it's not so easy as just saying, all right, we're back in, let's go. Iran has made very clear that it wants the United States to lift economic sanctions on Iran before Iran re-enters the limits of the nuclear deal. In the past couple of years, Iran has started to exceed some of the limits that were set under the 2015 agreement. It started to process more nuclear material. It's getting closer to building a bomb with this material. And so the United States is saying, look, Iran, you need to stop that before we'll lift the sanctions. Iran is saying, you need to lift the sanctions, United States, before we'll stop exceeding the limits. So we're kind of in a face-off to see who is going to blink first on this particular issue. It's not clear. And even when journalists asked Mr. Blinken about this yesterday at his first press conference at the State Department, he very notably sidestepped giving us any clarity on that.
Interesting. Well, that brings up Israel. Israel not a fan of the nuclear agreement. And so what is going to be the Biden administration's stance toward Israel?
You'll never see, I think, any administration take a negative stance towards Israel. The United States has for generations been one of the the big boosters and the big backers of Israel, in part because Israel has been one of the most reliable partners in a very kind of nefarious territory in the Middle East. So you're never going to see a reversal. And I think, in fact, you'll see the Biden administration take steps to try to warm relations with Israel. When Mr. Blinken was last in government, the Obama administration had a sort of frosty face-off with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And that was one reason why Mr. Netanyahu was even closer to President Trump, because President Trump took advantage of that kind of frostiness and really worked to try to overtly warm it. And I think that the new incoming or old incoming team of the Biden officials will really work to try to not revert back to that frostiness.
And how will this administration handle the Palestinians?
Well, already you're starting to see the State Department allow more coordination with the Palestinians than certainly we saw under the Trump administration. The PLO, I think, is going to be reopening its diplomatic mission here in Washington. That was something that the Trump administration had demanded be closed. I believe that the U.S.-funded mission to humanitarian aid and other benefits for Palestinian people will restart. The funding will be restarted for that mission. That was something, again, that the Trump administration had ended. So it is not going to be an either or for the Biden administration, as it seemed to look like under the Trump administration. The Biden administration has already made outreach efforts to the Palestinians, reversing the Trump administration's stance.
Okay, finally, a few seconds left. President Trump wanted to bring nearly all the troops back from Afghanistan very quickly. Is that going to be halted by President Biden or not?
Well, it's one of the things he is reviewing right now. I don't think that we can say, but what we can say is that the administration is reviewing everything that has to do with that deal that was struck almost a year ago between the United States and the Taliban. That was the deal in which the agreement to withdraw all American troops from Afghanistan was made. And if they're reviewing it, it means that that is back on the table, right? I mean, there's no decision yet. But clearly, the United States has said, and even before President Trump left office, that the Taliban seemed to be reneging on some of their commitments under that same deal, i.e., they were supposed to lessen violence in Afghanistan. And we've seen, even as recently in the last couple of days, some very harrowing moments in Kabul with police and security forces being targeted, civilians being killed. So I don't know where that is going to go, but I certainly think that that is back on the table.
Laura Jakes, diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the federal government warns of an increased threat of domestic terrorism. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Bram. The Department of Homeland Security issued a warning yesterday that the violence we saw during the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol could persist for weeks or maybe months. The DHS bulletin said that domestic extremists, quote, fueled by false narratives, could continue to mobilize to incite or commit violence. Well, a handful of Californians has been charged with violent entry into the Capitol and other federal crimes. Separately, we learned a man from Napa County was arrested 2 weeks ago and charged with possessing 5 homemade pipe bombs. He also had dozens of firearms, thousands of rounds of ammo, and text messages indicate he may have been targeting social media companies in the Bay Area and Governor Gavin Newsom and other Democratic lawmakers, all in a desperate attempt to keep President Trump in office. We're going to talk about this now with Kevin Grisham. He's the associate director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State San Bernardino. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, DHS warned that there may be continued violence related to the election, but the agency said back in September, well before the election, that white supremacists are the biggest threat to this country. So did it do anything back then to try to crack down on them?
Well, as far as we know, I mean, it was brought to the attention of both the acting Secretary Wolf as well as, of course, FBI Director Wray. And even though it was brought to their attention, there was some more focus on it. To what degree that focus was, I couldn't tell you, but it definitely seems like based in the outcome of January 6th, there was not as much focus as there probably should have been.
Right. Well, then we saw what happened, what transpired earlier this month at the Capitol. There were a number of Californians involved in this insurrection, most notably Ashley Babbitt, who was shot and killed, Air Force veteran from the San Diego area. A couple of people from here in Los Angeles, in Beverly Hills, a salon owner, for example, a doctor. So were you surprised by the number of Californians involved?
Not really. I mean, for really two reasons. I mean, one, California obviously being the largest populous state in the United States, just the numbers are very good possibility that there would be Californians there. But also, for some time, and actually for so many years, we've been tracking a growing number of people who are involved either in hate groups as defined by the Southern Poverty Law Center or the Anti-Defamation League, as well as movements within California like QAnon and the Boogaloo movement, some of these other sort of more extremists, some of which have actually involved in violence. So it didn't completely surprise us that that we'd see some Californians as they started to do arrest and looking into the background of people who had actually been in the protest and the siege on the Capitol.
How many people in California are involved in these movements and this far-right extremism?
Well, you know, we can't really tell you fully because obviously a lot of it is, a lot of it is people who may be simply sympathizers or supporters of some of these movements and groups, but are not actively engaged in the activities of those groups. And then you have core group members. Of course, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, currently as of 2019, we had 88 hate groups that they were tracking within California. And that doesn't even include some of the newer movements that have developed, like the Boogaloo movement or like QAnon, who do have violent elements within that movement as well, even though it's a conspiracy movement. So there's not really a really secure number that we would have, But just looking at the number of posts you see online in different platforms, I mean, it could be, you know, more than well over a few thousand people in California alone, and probably even higher than that, that have some sort of views that may align themselves with this sort of myriad of extremist and extremist ideology that's out there.
And what do you know about the man who was arrested, who allegedly was targeting Governor Newsom, the man from Napa?
Well, it's not somebody who'd actually showed up, obviously, on our radar at the center. And we track a lot of these things increasingly, have been for some time online and chat rooms and things like that. But in just looking at what has come out in the affidavit of his arrest by the federal government, it's pretty obvious that maybe he was associated in some form or fashion with the Three Percenters, which is a well-known extremist organization. Some of their members have been involved in violence. There were more than a few Three Percenters, as far as we know, that were at the protest and the siege on the Capitol. So the fact that he was linked, at least from the visuals that are included in that affidavit there, may suggest that he had extremist ideologies. And I'm sure more will come out as more comes out during the court case concerning his what he was involved with.
Well, who are the Three Percenters, and what's their ideology, and what is the name in reference to?
So the Three Percenters are basically a group. They've actually been around for some time, and the best way for people to understand it is they're basically a militia, and a militia in the sense that centered around this idea, their belief that only 3% of the population at the time of the Revolutionary War were actually Americans who fought. So they see themselves as sort of this elite group of people who are quote-unquote true patriots, is how they often refer to themselves on platforms, who are there really acting in their mind as a vanguard against government excesses. There's also some of them that also believe that the current government is actually not the true government, that actually that government is more of a corporation. You see some of that language online amongst them and a variety of other groups as well, that really the government that we have today is an illegitimate government for a variety of reasons. Within the state of California, of course, we've seen some of those making comments as it relates to Governor Newsom, as well as related to the anti-lockdown measures, as these being anti-American, and therefore they're going to act against those.
Are they involved in the recall effort?
How much they're involved in the recall effort, it's really hard to tell. I mean, because, you know, the problem is the recall effort is a very big, wide group of people who've been involved, who come from many different political persuasions. Obviously, many of them are the ones that, at least that we've seen in the media and that have been very public about being behind it, tend to be more from the conservative side. There are some Democrats, of course, also increasingly are middle-of-the-road Democrats who've been very public about wanting to recall the governor. But how much they're actually associated with these groups, we can't truly tell, because there can be people who just say, you know, they may post some tweets, they may post some things online, but how much they're actually involved in the movement is always questionable until we actually are able to look more into those backgrounds, or sadly enough, when they actually mm-hmm. take action related to that.
Yeah. And how much are these groups coordinating? Like, you've got the Three Percenters, you've got the Boogaloo Boys, you've got the Proud Boys, you've got the, you know, the QAnon adherents. Are they connecting in any way, or are they all isolated in their own separate cells?
Well, I would say, you know, the way to sort of look at it is prior to January, really leading up to January 6th. So if we look all the way back to right before the elections, and we were tracking a lot of these things online, the groups for the most part were sort of separate. They all had their sort of things they were doing online. The things that they were saying were some overlap, but for the most part was not complete overlap. And then as we got closer to the time of the election, we started seeing some merging of some of those ideologies and some calls for action. And then, of course, on January 6th, we definitely saw groups that were often sharing in the post-January 6th, the siege on the Capitol time. Since that time, really this month, we've actually seen a lot more people who traditionally have not probably been in a Proud Boys channel based on their characteristics of what they had posted in other channels. And all of a sudden, they're in Proud Boy channels, or they're in channels on Telegram and other platforms that are more akin to the white supremacy or neo-Nazis or other type Boogaloo movement or some of the Three Percenters or any of these other kind of groups. So you see a lot more merging. It's kind of an outcome, I would argue, of the deplatforming that occurred right in the aftermath of the siege on the Capitol.
Interesting. Well, Kevin, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Kevin Grisham from the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State San Bernardino. many of those violent pro-Trump insurrectionists who stormed the Capitol 3 weeks ago were armed with military-style tactical gear, helmets, body armor, zip ties, the type law enforcement and the military use as handcuffs. It was pretty shocking for most of us as we watched this unfold. But there is a shadowy world of military-style tactical training for civilians. And this has raised some big questions about the role this culture plays in prepping an armed populace for a world where violence is not only expected, but encouraged. Rachel Monroe joins me now. She has just written a big story in Wired where she spent time at a few of these tactical training facilities. Her story is called, "I Am Not a Soldier, But I Have Been Trained to Kill." Rachel, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you live in Texas and rural part of Texas. Did you know how to shoot?
I had shot guns a handful of times before going to these camps, but then, and then in preparation to go, a friend of mine gave me a bunch of lessons so I wouldn't show up seeming like a total fool or accidentally, you know, shoot somebody because I didn't know what I was doing.
But safe to say you're not an avid gun owner.
No.
So paint a picture of this place, the first place that you went to in Arizona. What was it like?
So the first stop on my tactical tour, I guess, was a place called Gunsight, which is in northern Arizona, and it's been around since the 70s. The assumption is that you have your handgun, and most of the courses they teach are using handguns, and you may need to use it to fight someday. It was founded by a guy who was very preoccupied with the idea of crime and the thought that criminals are out there and might prey on you at any moment. And so essentially you get a 5-day course where you shoot about 1,000 rounds, which is really like, I mean, they told us every day that at lunch we should wash our hands because we were handling so many bullets that the lead could potentially poison us.
Oh my gosh.
So you're just shooting all day, kind of learning how to react really quickly in the case that somebody attacks you. And so it's both kind of the practical training of how do you draw from the holster, how do you pull the trigger, how do you make all those moves really smooth, but also the mindset of just getting into that headspace where you might need to have a gunfight.
Who's in that mind space? I mean, do people think, oh, I'm going to be involved in a gunfight if I, you know, once I leave this place, that is a real possibility in my day-to-day life, that I'll be forced to engage in gunfire with someone, some bad person?
Well, it's interesting. There's a lot of mixed messaging that seems to happen at these training camps, because in part, one of the things they say is you get this training to avoid a fight. At the same time, you're practicing for a situation over and over again of perhaps a home invasion or a mugging or something like that. So it did seem like most of the folks that I trained with, a lot of them had concealed carry permits. They wore a gun and their handgun on them pretty much all moments in their daily life. A few of them carried like an AR-15, like a carbine, in their cars with them just in case something happened. And I think it really speaks to this culture of fear of violence and anxiety about violence, which is in a large part stoked by places like the NRA. The NRA issues a weekly or a monthly column where they share stories of citizens who had to fight back with their guns against criminals. You see these stories on cable news all the time. So even though the violent crime rate is much lower than it was 20 years ago, we're inundated with these messages of violence. And that seemed to be something that was the folks I was training alongside were really preoccupied with the idea that the world is a violent place and it's getting worse. And so it's up to you as an armed individual to stand up to that in some way.
And you went around the election, or like right before and right after the election. So what were people saying about the election and the need to learn these new skills?
Well, you know, I certainly heard a lot of jokes that made me uncomfortable, but I guess people felt like they were in the kind of company where they could make jokes about, you know, let's pretend the target is Nancy Pelosi. It's too bad it's not legal to shoot the press. Which I did object to that joke. I was like, I don't appreciate that. And then they did apologize, but it was definitely clear that sense of at least joking about violence was certainly not off the table. But then at the same time, there was a real understanding from some of the people that I spoke with who were in the gun industry that the Biden election was actually going to be good business for them because gun sales tend to go up. when people perceive that the administration is not gun friendly. So it was this funny mix of jokes about violence, performing actual violence, and then also the idea that this would be good for the gun industry.
And who were your fellow weekend warriors, if you will? Were they mainly guys?
It was overwhelmingly men. I will say that the tactical training world is definitely a very masculine world, and it's a very white world. Not everybody that I trained with was white, but certainly the majority of them were. And it's not a cheap hobby either. So these tended to be middle-aged men with good careers. There were a number of doctors and contractors, people who own their own businesses, people driving like $50,000 pickup trucks, I would say, was the demographic.
Yeah, one guy you profiled is an anesthesiologist here in Santa Barbara, and he was actually shot in Las Vegas during that deadly mass shooting, actually the deadliest mass shooting in American history. He and his wife were shot, she in the head, and luckily they survived. Incredibly, they survived. And here he was at this gun ranch with her.
Yeah, it was really fascinating to talk to him, and it made me think about how we as a culture in some ways have just accepted that we live in such a heavily armed world. And he was into guns before he was shot in a mass shooting, and had been to gun site where I went in Arizona a number of times beforehand, and said that one of the reasons that he knew that when he was in a mass shooting, like what was going on, was because he had been around gunfire before and he was able to identify it. Like that's what's going on here. And yet at the same time, you know, being shot, he was shot in the stomach and had to recover, took months to recover. He told me it didn't change his opinion around guns. And his wife, who was shot in the head, she didn't really have gun experience before, but 3 years after the shooting, she decided that she too wanted to get some of this training. And he told me that her first day out on the range, she's a very stoic woman, as he described her, but the first time the instructor said, you know, okay, take your gun out and go for a headshot, that phrase headshot really triggered something in her, understandably. And she kind of broke down, but then she stuck with it and continued to shoot for the rest of the weekend. And I don't know, there's something really heartbreaking about that to me, that the way to get over your trauma is just to sort of get used to guns.
But there's also a certain chicken and egg situation with what you're talking about, and that is when you have a culture like these gun ranches that you went to that prep people for shooting and prep people for a violent world, then they expect a violent world and in a way help perpetuate it. And in this particular case, the anesthesiologist and his wife, they were victims of it. And I guess I'm wondering if the people who went to this training, if they saw themselves as doing that, as perpetuating the very violence they were trying to protect themselves from.
Well, it's interesting. It's, you will hear a reasoning that's kind of exactly like what you're saying from a lot of these people, which is just sort of that the only solution to gun violence is more guns. It starts to feel like this weird kind of trap where if there are mass shootings, well, then what you need is you've got to get the teachers' guns and you've got to train the preachers to be able to take down a mass shooter. And we need more armed citizens to fight back against the bad armed citizens. And of course, in their head, they're always the good guys. But living in a heavily armed society, it's not quite, the more guns that we have doesn't always make us safer. It's a far cry from that.
So do you feel like you have training now that equals a police officer or a soldier? Like, do you feel like you have advanced tactical training that you could kill someone with a gun if you had to?
Oh, gosh. I certainly hope to never be in that position. I'd certainly not the training of a soldier. I will say that the second facility that I went to was much more militarized, and we were training with AR-15s from a veteran of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Learning kind of military techniques. But I was told by one of my instructors that I probably at this point had more firearm training than a lot of police officers. And that's one of the tricky things about these courses, that people will say, well, you know, if people have guns, don't you want those people who are armed to be trained? And maybe that's one of the problems, one of the reasons we see so many of these terrible shootings where officers shoot unarmed people or people who were running away. They panicked. They didn't have the training. And what we actually need, I heard this argument so many times, rather than to defund the police, we need more funding for the police. So everybody, all the police can get training like this, and every civilian should have training like this. And it's easy once you hear that over and over again to sort of see a kind of logic to it. But no, by the end of my training, I felt in no way qualified to make that kind of life or death decision. I'm never going to be a person who carries a gun. I can tell you, I don't think that I would be safer with a gun in my house.
I mean, was it fun at all going to these places?
I will say it was in its moments fun. I mean, I write in the piece about, you know, a very embarrassing moment where I ended up hiding behind a rock and crying. So that part wasn't that fun. But there is something about learning a new skill, about mastering a tool, about aiming, you know, trying to do something really quickly and precisely and accurately and getting better at it, that there's a real visceral satisfaction to like aiming at a target and trying to hit it. We also did a training where we went through basically a house simulation, and we're kind of like kicking open doors and shooting bad guys. And it's like almost like a video game in real life. And there was a kind of pleasure to it if I could kind of block out all of the ideological aspects to it.
Do you think any of those guys we saw at the Capitol went to these camps or a camp similar to them to get trained?
I mean, I think it's almost... certainly some of them have. I mean, we know that some of the men who allegedly plotted to kidnap the governor in Michigan had gone to tactical training. I read some newsletters from a guy who not only is a tactical trainer, but then trains other tactical trainers. He was urging folks to, you know, take up arms against the government. I mean, this messaging was very strong and out there in this world. And then you saw people wearing the gear, speaking into the walkie-talkies, doing all the kind of tactical cosplay that I also engaged in. So it would be hard for me to imagine there's not an overlap.
I love that you called it tactical cosplay. That is what it seemed like, people pretending, but in a very real way, kind of fantasy versions of themselves.
Oh, that was what was disconcerting about the experience for me, is that in some ways it was play and it was pretend, but on the other hand, we had real guns with real bullets and we were learning real skills, and the people that I was training alongside carry real guns with them in their daily life. And I think that's what we're learning more and more, is it's not so easy to draw a bright line between what is fake, what's joke, what's just for fun online, or isn't real, and then what becomes real, what spills out into the actual physical world.
Yeah. Rachel Monroe, she's a contributor to Wired. Her recent piece is called I'm Not a Soldier, But I've Been Trained to Kill, which you can check out at Wired's website. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, the comedian Cheech Marin has a serious art collection, and now you'll be able to see it in his new museum.
My mantra has always been, you can't love or hate Chicano art unless you see it. And that's been my goal, to get everybody to be able to see Chicano art.
Cheech Marin, he's here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Cheech Marin is best known as one half of the famous comedy duo Cheech and Chong. He is also one of the foremost collectors of Chicano art in the world. Marin has more than 700 pieces in his collection, and now they'll get a permanent home in Riverside, the Cheech Marin Center for Chicano Art, Culture, and Industry, or the Cheech for short, will be the first space in the country exclusively dedicated to showcasing Mexican-American art and culture. It's expected to open this fall, and Cheech Marin joins me now. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you. We last spoke, I think, around 13 years ago when you were showing some of your collection at LACMA. And you said during our interview that you wanted to expose the mainstream to Chicano art. Well, I guess now you're doing that.
I hope so. So we can get out of this pandemic and people can come to see the collection in person. But I fully assume that it will happen a year from now, less than a year from now even.
Yeah, in the fall. So hopefully everyone will be vaccinated by then and people will be going to museums, hopefully.
Yeah, well, I'm vaccinated already, so I'm going.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
On getting the vaccine as well as opening the museum. So you've been collecting art for how long?
Well, put Chicano art since the mid-80s, about 85, I started putting this collection together. And that wasn't the purpose when I first started buying Chicano art. I just wanted, initially, I just wanted something green to go over the couch, you know. Mm-hmm. And so as I started collecting, I kept seeing this pattern emerge and this picture emerging. And what I realized that these artists were telling a story of a culture over a long period of time and continue to do so as we speak. So I was turned on to that fact very early. And I realized that after the urging of some of my friends in the art community that I had to show these pieces of art because, you know, they don't do any good in storage or under my bed. And so I set about to make that happen. A long road, that one.
Really? How long did it take to get this museum finalized?
Oh, the museum is just finalized, but I've been displaying the collection for, God, I don't know, 30 years? Something like that around. Yeah, so it's, We've played in over 50 museums across the nation and in Europe, and which is highly unusual for a private collection because museums don't like to do that, and I understand why. You know, their assumption is you're trying to increase the value of your collection, and as soon as you get all the press, you're going to sell it. Has never been my intention, nor is it my intention right now. I want everybody to be able to see Chicano art because my mantra has always been, you can't love or hate Chicano art unless you see it. And that's been my goal, to get everybody to be able to see Chicano art.
Okay, so for people who don't know, what is it? What is Chicano art?
Chicano art is art by Chicanos, which is an othered section of an already othered community. You know, a Chicano, being a Chicano is a voluntary category. There's no box in the census that you can check off that says Chicano. You can do Mexican American or even Hispanic, but there's no Chicano place in there, you know. And it comes from the evolution of the term comes from a long time ago, where it was a diss from Mexicans to other Mexicans living in the United States, and the concept being that the Mexicans who had moved from Mexico and now lived in the United States along the border in tin shacks were no longer truly Mexicanos because they had left their country. They were something less. They were smaller. They were chicos. They were chicanos, mm-hmm. little satellite Mexicans living in the U.S. And as that became that insult became an emblematic badge of pride, that Chicano movement spread throughout the country. And I'm of the belief that Chicano art is probably the most influential and important school of art in American history right now, because no other category describes their culture in the way that this movement does.
And it really became a political force, this art movement, in the 70s and 80s with ASCO, the East LA Art Collective.
Uh-huh.
And ASCO meaning what, like disgust, right?
It's nausea. It means nausea.
Nausea. Uh-huh. At the prevailing, political situation and the Vietnam War.
When they
put
their workshop, the audience said, "Estos pinturas me da asco. They're making me nauseous," because they were really confrontational, because they kind of represented a kind of a punk movement that had come into play at that time. And they were, ASCO was not necessarily a political group. They were a performance group at first that learned how to paint and learned how to make art.
Hmm. So you've got people like Gronk and Harry Gamboa in it. Do you have pieces from them in your collection that we will be able to see in the new museum?
I think I have more pieces by Gronk than any other artist in the collection.
So that would be a yes.
That would be a yes.
And tell us about some other highlights you have in the collection that, that we'll be able to see.
You know, I started collecting from the kind of the beginning of the movement. So there's a Los Four, which was the first Chicano collective comprised of Carlos Almaraz, Frank Romero, Beto de la Rocha, and one other guy, I can't remember. But anyways, it was the first four, and they were the first four coming into a collective that kind of identified themselves as Chicanos. Carlos Almaraz just had his first major retrospective at LACMA, I think 2 years ago. But he has since left this world and is in another world. But his art is, I mean, he's like the John Coltrane of Chicano art.
Well, it's really exciting that you have this museum coming online, especially in a time when people are worried that art institutions will suffer, and we're not seeing a lot of expansion in the art world these days. So thank you for doing this. And
I owe it all to the city of Riverside, who came to me with this proposition of establishing the Cheech Museum there in Riverside, California, because they had a beautiful, iconic mid-century building that they had to repurpose because it was the town library, and they were building a new Jetsons library down the street, you know, with neon and swirling stuff. And they had to repurpose this beautiful mid-century building. And through a set of circumstances, I was doing a show there, a Works on Paper show at the Riverside Art Museum. And the city manager said, this would be a perfect place to enshrine this collection. And they came to me with this proposition, and I didn't understand it at first. I thought, well, you want me to buy a museum? Well, I don't have that much money. You know, no, we want to give you the museum and you give us the collection. Well, that could work for you guys and us guys and everybody in between, you know?
Yeah, it sounds like a win-win for everybody. So Riverside will spend about $1 million a year, I understand, operating it, but they hope to generate $3 million a year.
I hope it's more. You know, I hope it's more. I'm really excited about bringing a focus to this particular city and this particular movement. And you couldn't choose a better place to see Chicano art than Riverside, California, when this museum opens.
Okay. And again, that's going to open in Riverside in the fall, hopefully.
Yeah, in the fall, hopefully.
So, well, Cheech Marin, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure. And look for the Cheech.
Look for the Cheech. Words to live by. Coming up, Evan Kleinman is here to tell us of her obsession with chili crisp. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb chop?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
All right, it's a new year, so let's talk about a new food trend. And if you like your food spicy, then listen up. Here with me is Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food, with what she predicts could be the food trend for 2021. Chili crisp and salsa matcha. Hi, Evan.
Hi there. I mean, I think 2020 was the year that we all became aware that there are millions of kinds. But the pandemic, I think, really sort of jump-started a lot of small businesses making these and selling them because it's so relatively easy.
What is it, first of all, for people who don't know?
So chili crisp is, as I'm saying those two words, my mouth just filled up with water, is a condiment that is basically chili oil, but you keep the chopped chilies that have been infused with oil, and there have been many other things added. So let's say alliums, maybe shallots, maybe onion, garlic, maybe nuts or seeds or different spices. So all of these different ingredients, along with the chopped chilies of the creator's choice, are infused in a bath of boiling oil. And it creates the most savory, addictive condiment known to man, I think, that can be used on everything.
Oh my gosh, you are an evangelist for the chili crisp. And what is salsa matcha?
So salsa matcha actually probably, if we go into history, predates chili crisp, given that chilies came to China from Latin America. Mm-hmm. It's a combination of chilies and nuts and seeds and spices bathed in an oil. The first time I ever had it was in Baja California at that incredible raw food stand in Ensenada, drizzled all over a tostada of like raw scallops or raw clams. Mm. It's really fabulous. I've also had it, I think, on pambazos. It's just a different kind of salsa because it's so seedy, and the chilies are not pureed. You know, they're like just chopped.
So you can actually chew on them if you want.
Yeah, they're crispy.
Crispy and delicious. Do you only use it on Mexican food?
No, I use it on everything. Truly, one of my favorite ways to use it is on simple vegetables. Like, I really, really love broccoli, and I like it. You know, I'm so used to how we used to make it at my restaurant, which was just blanched broccoli with olive oil and lemon juice and garlic that had been infused. So this is sort of like that, but on steroids. So I'll just make a bunch of broccoli, keep it in the fridge, and I'll take it out of the fridge, even cold, and just put a couple tablespoons of chili crisp on it and munch away on eggs, like in an omelet, and even famously on soft serve ice cream, or any kind of ice cream, really.
I was just going to suggest that because it seems perfect to go with ice cream. The hot with this cold.
It's so good on ice cream.
Oh, that sounds so good.
And it's really fun to make. So in addition to the millions of varieties that we can find, many of the makers are right here in LA, I'm also going to include on the website a couple of recipes so that people can experiment with it once they've tasted someone else's.
But is this one of those things where with, you know, yeah, you can make it and that's fun, but it's really better to buy it from someone who knows how to do it?
Actually, I don't think so. It's so simple. I think that once you start eating it, and what I tend to do with these kind of condiments is when I finish one jar, the next jar I buy is a different brand until I've tasted several of them. And then I get to know what it is I really like, what I'm looking for. So if you're a person who really loves peanuts and you think you really liked X's chili crisp, but there weren't enough peanuts in it, or there wasn't enough crispy garlic in it, then you can retool it to your palate. Like right now, I think I have 6 different ones in my pantry.
Well, where are a few places we can look to get it?
Well, the original Lao Gan Ma, which is the Chinese chili crisp with the lady on the cover, you can get at any Asian store. And I recommend for people who have never tried chili crisp before to get that, because it's like the original, most famous version.
Mm.
But then you can go online. We'll have links for all of these different places that I mention. Right now for salsa matcha, it's being made by Taco Maria. He's making 3 different kinds. I'm sure you can get it on the Taco Maria website, but also Masienda, M-A-S-I-E-N-D-A, the procure of heirloom corn, who sells to many chefs all over the city. They have it on their website. And then our local cookbook store now serving carries quite a few of these. Fly by Jing Sichuan Chili Crisp, which is fantastic. They carry Boon, Umame Chili Oil, Drip Calibration, which I think is sort of genius because The chef who's making that has done sort of a mashup of a Chinese chili crisp style with Calabrian chilies. So also, you know, Calabrian chili paste is a separate addiction that has a very distinct flavor from those chilies, and he's combined that. And then Momofuku makes one that I have to say is one of my favorites, Momofuku Chili Crunch.
So you'd get that just by going to the Momofuku?
Their website. Yeah, they've developed an entire pantry worth of condiments that I think are really quite good.
Oh, wow. I just love how chefs and restaurateurs are, you know, the creative ones are really adapting and coming up with new ideas and new ways of exploring food.
Yeah, what do they say? Desperation is the mother of invention?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. And I think what this period of time has done, even though it is horrific and a cause of great anxiety, has caused people to really reach deep and figure out what they can make in large batches that they can sell retail. And this is a perfect example of that.
Well, thank you, Evan.
You're welcome, Madeline. I'm so happy to share my fervor with you.
Oh, yes. Well, you certainly did. Some hot stuff. Evan Kleinman is host of KCRW's Good Food. I love our director, Michelle Aloy. Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. See you tomorrow.